Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hi everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale and I am your host, a writer and film critic. I am going to be talking to Thomas M. Purr today. He is an academic and writer. He's published widely and he's just got a new book called Fate in Film, A Deterministic Approach to Cinema. It's a really interesting book. Looks at a fascinating swathe of films from the Coen brothers to Christopher Nolan. Lucrezia Martel, lots of brilliant, Stanley Kubrick, lots of brilliant filmmakers, and a really interesting concept, which, as you will see from our conversation, or as you will hear from our conversation, is applicable to so much in cinema, and indeed the whole idea of cinema itself seems wrapped up with an idea of freedom, determinism, fate. So really fascinating. I hope you enjoy it. If you do, please remember to like and subscribe to the podcast. If you could drop reviews, that would be great. I am also available for interviews or whatever. If you have your own podcast or you wish to promote our podcast, that would be super. That would be super duper or fan dabby dozy, depending on your preferred adjective of choice. You can follow me at Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty, where I tweet far too much. So you might want to follow me, mute me, and then follow me and mute me and unmute me when you feel like it, because I understand Twitter is a disease. I think Twitter is a pathology. I mean, I get a lot from it, especially humor, especially film recommendations. It's wonderful in that sense, but then if there was one invention that I would disinvent, that might be, oh wait a minute, nuclear bombs. Yeah, sorry, nuclear bombs. I disinvent nuclear bombs. Anyway, enough of me jabbering away, because the conversation is going to be worth listening to. You want to get straight to that. So enjoy the conversation.
I had a similar experience to you, actually, because I'd been writing articles for different publications here and there, online magazines and so forth, for some years. And then kind of looking back on them, I realized that a lot of them either explicitly or implicitly had to do with this idea of fate or determinism, or characters' lack of freedom, or, you know, their delusion that they control their lives. And I kind of realized after the fact that I'd been writing about that, I guess kind of subconsciously for years. And that's when I had the idea that there might be a book here. because I just kept revisiting this idea. And I think the reason that I kept revisiting it is because, in my mind at least, it's so prevalent in contemporary film, especially contemporary genre film. And because you mentioned, you know, the ending being the beginning. And as soon as you said that, I thought, you know, the first shot of Midsommar and the painting, that the sort of medieval looking painting that maps out the entire narrative, so that 10 seconds into the movie, you've kind of seen the whole movie. The whole narrative is presented to you as a still image almost, which just emphasizes that everything you're about to see is already there. It's already happened, literally too, because the film is complete. The whole thing is wrapped up in a, you know, in a film canister. The beginning and the middle of the and the end are they're all there. And this idea that we're experiencing a movie in real time, that false movement, because obviously what you're really looking at is just rapidly moving still images, and then that idea kind of dovetails with this theory or this fear that time itself is very much the same, that the past and the present and the future all essentially exist already now. And the movement through time that we perceive is ultimately an illusion.
Yeah. That, I mean, you quote quite a couple of scientists in the book, and Brian Greene comes up as one of your sort of examples in terms of thinking about time and from a physicist's point of view. I find that really when I'm not reading about films or reading novels, then that's the sort of stuff I'm reading and being baffled by, but in a creative and enjoyable fashion. I mean, that whole, I remember a really good lecture about poetry from Christopher Ricks that I attended. I had the opportunity to attend at Liverpool.
And the way that film in the films themselves, and then also just in the medium as a whole,
Thomas.
Connects with...
I think I lost you for a little while then.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what happened. I'm not sure exactly when I lost you. I think about 30 seconds ago.
Oh, okay. So when we were talking about science books?
Yeah, exactly. I started mentioning something about science, and then I think I talked on thinking, and it had frozen. So I didn't notice until just now that...
Oh. that I was blathering on. Yeah.
No, wait, it wasn't that. It was funny because I said something about Brian Greene, and I was expecting you to go, ah, yeah, of course I mentioned guy. And instead you just sort of looked blank, and now I've realized that that blank expression was the frozen image of you on the video.
I wasn't just silently assessing the situation.
Exactly like Tom Cruise in Magnolia. Wait a second, my camera's doing it now as well. Let's go from the Brian Greene. So yeah, you use that as one of your sort of reference points.
Yes. So his book, specifically The Fabric of the Cosmos, was really helpful for me. And I'll preface anything I'm about to say with I am anything but a science expert. And the science that I draw from is really, I guess, like popular science books, like you said, that kind of general reader text about, you know, time and black holes and the universe. And I just find all that really fascinating. And the metaphor that Green uses in his book when he's tackling this idea about whether all of time, past, present, future, sort of already exists as this discrete object almost. He uses two metaphors. He compares it to a bread loaf, and he compares it to a bread loaf, and he also compares it to Frozen River, that, you know, there's this idea that time is like a flowing river. And that makes me think of like stream of consciousness writing. Even there's this idea that your lived experience is like this malleable flowing experience, but that it might in fact be a frozen river. And he even, in that very same book, Fabric of the Cosmos, he even makes a connection to film. He says that, you know, like the still frames in a film, the different time slices in the time river, or the different time slices in the time loaf, pick your metaphor, it's the same sort of idea, that they coexist. Mm-hmm. It's like this temporal simultaneity that is just sort of beyond our perception. We, you know, in theory it makes sense, but it's difficult to square that theory with the notion that we can change our futures, or that we have, you know, total uninhibited freedom in what we do and where we go and how we think.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's like it's like a dance. You know, the dance exists, you know that it's choreographed and there are certain movements and there's a beginning and a middle and an end. But at any point during that dance, you are making the decisions to create that moment, those series of movements. Yeah. I find that fascinating. So one example you use in the introduction, which is a brilliant moment of, I don't know if Freud, it would enter into the Freudian idea of the uncanny, but that idea of in The Shining, you have this flashback, in the sense that, I mean, as a viewer, you have a flashback. When you see that photograph on the wall, you sort of suddenly go, oh, how many times has he walked past that? How many times have we seen that? Have we walked past that? Could I rewatch it and zoom in and find him already there?
Yeah. Oh, I love that shot. And one of the... That was a realization I had while writing the book. That was kind of like an aha moment for me while I was writing, because it's such a baffling shot. And I think we're kind of built as movie watchers. When you see that scene, your kind of knee-jerk reaction is, oh, okay, he's been like sucked into the past. He's been like absorbed by the hotel somehow. But then, like you said, I think another possibility that is maybe less often discussed is the possibility that he's always been in the picture, that, you know, the whole time that they were in the hotel, and all the time leading up to the hotel, and it's not like he was sucked into the picture. He was always in the picture. And if he was always in the picture, then, you know, like they say in the film, you've always been the caretaker. So he's that's kind of an interesting way, I think, that Kubrick makes the past and the future kind of feed into each other in a really interesting way.
Absolutely. And I don't remember that. So I'm saying this, and this might well be a misremembering, but I have a feeling that ending with the photograph was kind of like a really last minute addition to the process of shooting. I'm not sure. Do you remember if that's the case, or?
I honestly don't. I'm not sure. That would be interesting to know. I can't answer that question, but I do know that there was a cut sort of epilogue that showed that's like Wendy in the hospital, I think, and then she's notified by the authorities that they couldn't find Jack's body in the snow. I think was the thing that they cut. I think Roger Ebert talks about that in his review.
Apparently, the ball bounces from that Danny was playing with somehow.
Really?
Yeah, it turns up in the scene. I think I've seen that cut. I'm pretty sure I've seen that cut.
It exists.
Yeah. There's an extended version. I think they might have even released it sort of relatively recently with one of the anniversaries that came up.
I gotta check that out. And I would love to see it, but at least thinking about it on paper, I'm glad they cut it. Because I think it's if you said, oh, like, his body disappeared, ooh, that then that reinforces the, I would say, like the kind of simpler interpretation that he was somehow sucked into the past. And I think that if there was the focus on whether or not his physical body is still in the present, it would kind of go against this idea that maybe he's always been in the photograph. So I think the implications of not knowing what happens to the body and not being quite sure why or how he's in the picture is far more, like you said, it kind of taps into the uncanny and it's far more frightening, and like baffling. And so I think that's, but I do want to see that. I'm a little embarrassed to say I didn't know that that cut existed. I thought it was like stuff of movie lore that it was like a lost scene or something. I have to look that up.
No, I yeah, I'm pretty sure it is, and I'm pretty sure I've seen it, although I might be misremembering and I've seen clips of it or something like that. And I'm pretty sure the thing about the discussion about the ending is in Michel Simon's book, or the sort of series of interviews that he did with Simon, which is a brilliant book, one of my first ever film books that I remember getting out of the library as a kid and reading.
Oh, wow. Very
Yes, yeah,
cool.
it's a beautiful book, beautiful.
What's it called again?
I think it's just called Kubrick, but the author is Michel Simon, the
Okay.
French journalist from Postif, who and guest of the podcast, previous guest of the
Oh, okay,
podcast.
cool.
Yeah, he interviewed everybody. He's legendary. He's in his 80s now, but he's from he was a, one of the last people to interview Terrence Malick during
Oh,
his
wow.
Days of Heaven period.
Oh man, they must have so many great stories.
They do. I mean, I love those. There's a British journalist called Derek Malcolm who's a who's who again is probably in his late 70s, and I meet him every now and again at festivals, and he just has he has stories from when being a journalist was a totally different thing, going to.
Yeah. Not 90% online, right?
Exactly. Not sort of blogging and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So,
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
no, I was just gonna coming back to the idea of there being an alternative ending as well. How does that sort of go into your idea of, because the idea that a world exists in the film which is sort of frozen and there, but then if you have like there's this cut and that cut and the other cut and the endings change radically,
Yeah.
how does that play into that idea of fate?
That's an interesting question. I think it really speaks to how what's what the filmmaker decides to show or not show can have such a drastic effect on the meaning of the film or the potential meanings of the film. So I think to tie it to the idea of fate, I might say that the in this case, his decision to cut that final scene, I don't know, that the first I'm kind of thinking of like the director or the editor or whomever as like this godlike figure that they're having this control over you, the viewer, that if they leave the scene in, that makes you that sort of forces you to think a certain way about what the movie means. And if they take that very same scene out, that also affects in a very different way what you think the movie means. So I guess my convoluted response to that would be that it sort of emphasizes the control, like the deterministic control that the artist has over their audience in terms of what they decide to show or not show to you. I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. It's absolutely. I mean, it's it just seems to be that the whole thing, like it seems to go against, and this is why I like I really enjoyed reading the book, and I really enjoyed thinking about these things that the book provoked. There's such a sense at the moment that watching stuff, the primary emotional response is surprise. That's the thing that's got to be preserved. You know, I'm not going to watch any trailers. I'm not going to see anything. No spoilers. Because I want and you know, reaction videos of people watching stuff and, you know, a surprise death on well, Game of Thrones has been and gone, I expect, but that sort of moment and people like, oh my God, what happened? How did that happen?
Yeah.
And how that is a really recent sort of trend and like, you know, art is much more about telling you exactly what's going to happen. And foreshadowing and showing, you know, this is the tragedy of Hamlet. It doesn't end in a dance. You know, this is a comedy of Much Ado About Nothing. It does end in a dance, you know?
Yeah.
And that's on the poster that before you got, you know, someone pointed out that Rocky IV, you know, I think it was me actually, but anyway, on the poster of Rocky IV, it's the last shot of the movie.
That's right. With the flag draped over him, right? Yeah,
winning, you know, Rocky IV, come and see him win, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And, first of all, big fan of Rocky IV. I love the robot. I love that he convinces Russia to stop being communists or whatever. It's a very emotional ending. But that's just it. Like when you mentioned spoilers, I talk about that a little bit in the conclusion of the book, and I agree with you. It's definitely a very recent phenomenon, and in a way, I think it sort of like crystallizes how we go into movies pretending as if it's more than pretending as if we don't know what's going to happen. It's pretending as if we're experiencing it in real time. Like we don't want to. I think the reason that spoilers bother a lot of people is because it breaks that illusion that when you sit down in the theater and watch the movie, that you're seeing movement occur in real time. And because a lot of the time spoilers really aren't that spoilery, you know, like if you said, you know, in one of the Superman or Batman movies, like the Zack Snyder ones, if you were to say like, oh, Superman dies in one of them, then a super fan would get like really pissed that you spoiled that Superman dies. But it's like, well, if you're even a moderate fan of comic books, you know that Superman is going to die at some point. So it's less that it's like a surprise and more that it breaks that illusion of like real time movement.
Yeah. It's kind of like a reinforced sort of naivety, if you like, because I think of it in this way. This doesn't necessarily apply to films exclusively. In fact, I think if I went to see a comedian do a routine or a play and I had a great time and it touched me and it did all the things it needed to do, and then the next night I accidentally went back, I went to another club and it was the same comedian and he was doing the same routine, I would feel betrayed. No matter how nonsensical that reaction is, because you know he's doing a routine, he's a professional comedian, he's not just turned up and been spontaneously hilarious.
Right.
But that spontaneity is something which you give, that presumption of spontaneity, that presumption of naive sort of like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. And it's like, and even as a critic, you kind of have to sort of turn off a bit of your critical thing
I mean, I read a review of a film recently, and it said, you know, this character ends the way this character always ends in this kind of film. And it was like a social realist film, and it's like, yeah, you know this guy's not gonna get onto a government training scheme and be fine. You know, it's only one way this is going. And it's kind of like, I felt a little bit that the critic wasn't playing the game. It was like, oh yeah, that's true. You know, it's almost like an argument against genre, because a genre is about pretending that this thing is spontaneous, but we all know it's going to end badly or well or whatever, depending on the genre.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what you said about seeing the same, like accidentally seeing the same set again and feeling betrayed, that kind of reminds me of the remakes that I talk about that I write about in the book. Specifically the carbon copy remake, where a director, to the best of their ability, tries to replicate as close as possible, you know, shot for shot, an entire film. And so, like, I write about Gus Van Sant doing Psycho in 1998 and Michael Haneke doing Funny Games again in America in 2007. And I think it's kind of the same idea, because they're in both cases, I think both directors were very open in publicity, for example, and saying, like, my goal was to truly remake it shot for shot. And yet that was kind of like a common criticism of those films, you know? And it's like, well, like you said, you're not, if you're going into it knowing that that's what they wanted to do, and then you feel like betrayed by that, it's kind of like what you said, you're not playing the game. You're not playing, they're inviting you to play this game, and you're kind of refusing to play it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, oh no, it's fake. The Michael Haneke US version of Funny Games is fake because it's just a copy of the original. But the original was a fake. I mean, the original had a shot list and had a script and had a casting session and, you know, back and back and back.
Exactly, yeah. And then especially Funny Games is especially interesting because obviously it has that notorious remote control scene. So it's like the original version of the film already has this self-awareness built into it and this deterministic theme built into it, and that, you know, the family's going to die, and there's nothing they can do about it. And even if the mother shoots one of the killers in the chest, they can just rewind it and redo it, because they're, you know, the family's fate is totally in the hands of the two killers and totally in the hands of the filmmaker. And then to remake that is especially interesting. It's like a Russian doll of like the film's self-awareness. It's like a copy of a copy, which I think is really interesting. And I think those remakes get a bad rap unfairly. I think the 2007 Funny Games and the 1998 Psycho are like fascinating. And I think their success hinges on the existence of the original. Their reason for existing is based on is like dependent on something that's already out there. So that whole idea I just think is really fascinating. And like you said, it breaks the illusion of spontaneity. And I think maybe that's why some people reacted so strongly to them. But you can't win, because if you drastically remake something, then people are going to be upset about that too. So there's almost something sort of self-critical about those carbon copy remakes, because it's sort of, in my mind, it's sort of the filmmaker saying, like, oh, you don't want us to mess with the original? Okay, you got it. Here's the original again.
Yeah, with Vince Vaughn.
Right. Yeah. I'm not going to defend the Vaughn casting, but Yeah, I love those movies. It's fun watching them to the best of your ability, side by side. But yeah, I'm not gonna put Vaughn up there with Perkins. I'm not gonna go that far.
I mean, that's in a way, I found that casting really interesting because, at that point in his career, Vince Vaughn was like Swingers. He was this sort of affable lunk, and you pretty much a million miles away from Perkins in sort of physical stature and star power and all the rest of it. I mean, Funny Games, I do like the American remake. I think it makes more sense in America. In American, in American. I'm not sure if that's a way of saying it, but you know what I mean. It's like, the only problem I have with it is that it casts two actors who are very much art house regulars in Naomi Watts and Tim Roth. And I think, especially that stage of his career, Tim Roth was doing a lot of art house work. He was, in Werner Herzog films and whatnot. I think it would have been better if it had Ne Liam Neeson as the father, or Sylvester Stallone. I mean, because it really prefigures Taken. That's what it is kicking against. It's kicking against the daddy revenger, you come after my family.
And that kind of fasting, or sorry, that kind of casting would draw in more of the audience that I think he was trying to get, like the, because, Haneke said the whole point for really his only reason almost for remaking it was to make it more accessible to the intended audience, being Americans. And I think the film, like the remake, would have been more successful if it was packaged in a way that would kind of trick the everyday moviegoer who goes to it thinking that they're going to see, a Taken, and then just being blindsided by it. But it wasn't like packaged and delivered that way in the United States. It was very much, it had like a pretty big release, but it was very much sort of advertised and promoted as like a sort of art house film. So I think it failed. I don't know who's to blame for that in terms of, I think it's like a matter of marketing. Like they mismarketed it to an art house audience when they should have been trying to like dupe, maybe that's a judgmental term, but they were trying to trick people who just wanted to go and have like a fun time at the movies, and that would have been more effective in getting his message across.
But I think actually your choice of word there is right, and that's probably why they didn't market it in that way, because they didn't want to have a host of very angry people going, okay, you've mismarketed this to us. We thought it was this and it's something else. I think there was a thing there that wasn't necessarily accidentally mismarketed. It was probably quite consciously, we can't have, families turning up expecting to see Bruce Willis kick ass, and
They're just coming out and questioning their
existence. Yeah, exactly.
existence.
And I mean, going to the heart of your thesis, that this is a European view of determinism, which American movies, a vast overgeneralization, obviously, but tends with their sort of proactive protagonists tend to pragmatic resolution-seeking people, would kick against. It's not no, we're not doomed. There's always a solution. There's always I mean, look at Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List. Who else could look at the Holocaust and think, yeah, but what about the guys who got out? What about the escape plan? There's always a way. There's always a way, which is like,
It's
really?
interesting you it's interesting you bring up Schindler's List, because doesn't Haneke like really hate that movie? I've seen in I think I saw in an interview that he was upset by that movie, and that Spielberg was like creating using the Holocaust as a way to generate suspense is I think what he took issue with.
Yeah, I mean, I've not heard Haniger's take specifically. That doesn't surprise me at all. I would never in a million years have assumed that Michael Haneke would approve of a Spielberg movie, except to piss you off, you know, except if it...
Yeah, although I did hear that, I read somewhere that I guess he was a big fan of Paul Schrader's Dog Eat Dog, which is really interesting, because that is like the total opposite of the kind of movie you would expect him to like.
Dog Eat Dog is still has, you know, the guy's screwed. You know, I mean, yeah, it still has a really pessimistic sort of view of the universe.
That's true.
What about a big one of the whether I want to go into some more of these films, because one of the things that I loved about the book was there's such an excellent choice of movies that there it really keys in with a lot of the films that I'm interested in as well. So Jonathan Slater, you talk about his Identity trilogy. Can you just explain a little bit what you mean by that?
Oh, sure. So he only has three feature films.
So it has to be a trilogy.
Yeah, so it has to be a trilogy, and that's it. What's your next question?
Okay. No,
it's Sexy Beast, Birth, and Under the Skin, and the superficially they seem to be very, very different films. So Sexy Beast being a very stylish, sort of like poppy gangster film that's funny and colorful, and has, you know, like a Britpop soundtrack. We've got Birth, which is this, you know, very austere melodrama about, you know, reincarnation and these very like muted colors, and it's a very romantic movie also, I think. And then Under the Skin being as, you know, as far away from those as you can probably get. You know, Under the Skin is closest to something like an avant-garde film, or even like a silent movie. There's so little dialogue, or so the dialogue is almost like secondary to anything that you see on the screen. And of course, they're three very different genres. So you've got the gangster film, you've got the, you know, the spiritual melodrama, and you've got the abstract science fiction film. But the through line for all three of them is that, and what I really attach to and I think is really fascinating, is that all three of those movies in some way are about a protagonist who is trying to assume a new identity and fails to do so. And that overarching theme, I don't think is a mistake or a coincidence. I think it's something that Glazer is tapping into to kind of comment on whether or not it was a conscious decision. I think it's a commentary on how it's impossible to become something that you're not, like or very difficult to become something that you're not. So like in Sexy Beast, Gal is trying to live the life of the, you know, the retiree lounging by the pool, but inevitably he gets sucked back into his gangster life. And Nicole Kidman's Anna in Birth is trying to move on with her life after her husband's death, and you know, get married again and have another marriage and start a family and start this new life, but she gets sucked back into her old romance when this, you know, this boy shows up claiming to be her reincarnated husband. And then in Under the Skin, the unnamed alien attempts to live the life of a human. You know, she kind of ditches her mission of seducing and harvesting men, and kind of goes off the grid and tries to kind of plays with this identity of being, of trying to be a human, and then, you know, that fails. They're destroyed. They're caught. So I just think it's, I think it's really interesting that when a filmmaker, especially one who hasn't made a lot of films, has this series of movies that seem very disparate, but share this like core preoccupation with the difficulty of assuming a new identity. And then, so hence the, you know, what I call the his identity trilogy.
Yeah. I mean, that's so interesting. It's such a, and it just makes me think of so many other ideas in terms of how that relates to other films as well, and also to as Glazer as a filmmaker. So, for instance, other films, I was thinking of Unforgiven as being a good example of a film there where someone tries to carve out a new identity, and ultimately is like, no, you're always going to be an alcoholic and a murderer, and there's no way right. around that, you know.
Yeah.
But also, just as Glazer as a filmmaker seems really interestingly postmodern in that sort of way of sort of quite comfortably taking on projects which seem to be very close to previous projects that have been. So, for instance, when he does yes. Sexy Beast, it's really close to the British gangster movie. As typified by The Long Good Friday and Villain and all these films that we've had, but it really sits, right. it feels like it sits very, it's not in any way really trying to differentiate itself from them. It's like, no, I'm totally embrace that.
Yeah.
Birth feels like, it feels like now we're talking about AI, like somebody has typed into an AI, you know, a film by Roman Polanski circa Rosemary's Baby, and here mm-hmm. but telling this story instead.
Yeah. Know? Yeah.
And the same thing for Under the Skin feels like Nicholas Roeg's they all feel like riffs off very specific films. It feels like Nicholas Roeg's Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah, for sure.
And I got a chance to talk to Scarlett Johansson after on the release of Under the Skin, and asked her, you know, Did you watch The Man Who Fell to Earth as sort of David Bowie's sort of seems to be a little bit of that in your performance? And she hadn't yeah. seen the film, so it was.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So that made for it's really interesting to sort of encounter filmmakers and people involved in cinema who.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You know, for very good reasons. Don't spend as much time watching films as we do, you know, because they're having way too much fun being film stars, you know.
That's fascinating. I you're right, absolutely, that he very much is aware of sort of like the ancestry of the genre he's working in,
right?
And in many ways respects the expectations of that genre, you know, as strange and, you know, challenging as Under the Skin can be, it has the creepy music, it has the scary harvesting scene, Sexy Beast has the big complex, clever heist. Berth has, Berth has sort of like the like strange family dynamics that you would see in, like you said, like a Rosemary's Baby. So I agree. I always find it even just
like the haircut of the Mia Farrow haircut, you know, it's
absolutely And the and how they explore, you know, motherhood and marriage and, you know, the sort of the husband who has, you know, maybe ulterior motives, and it's it's all there, but it's but he plays with it too. So I like that. I think that's something that I love about genre films, is when filmmakers kind of they decide to play in that sandbox, but they also mess around with it too. So they got like one foot in tradition and another foot in just like breaking the rules in that tradition, while somehow still honoring those rules.
I mean, another film that sort of keys in with this idea of fate as well, and does a similar thing to what you're describing, I think, would be No Country for Old Men, the Coen Brothers film. Because, you know, again, if you're the jaundiced critic watching that, you're thinking to yourself, okay, this guy's not gonna survive this movie. There's no way he's surviving this movie.
Right.
And so, you know, the whole of the pursuit is based on doom, you know. But then the play the twist and the play that you're talking about is that final confrontation that you're expecting happens off screen, and you just come across the aftermath. It's like you want to follow these two stories, but there's no inevitability that you're going to actually swap over to them at the right point. You're going to be following the wrong guy when this happens.
Right. Yeah, I love that. And I love, speaking of like bucking those expectations of like the chase film, that Anton Chigurh just like, he just wanders off, and there's no, like you said, there's no big showdown. You might expect, you know, the big confrontation between him and the Tommy Lee Jones character or whatever. But no, I mean, he gets in a car accident, totally by accident, total coincidence, and wanders off, and then that's it. He's gone. But like you said, that in many ways that's a film that is just embodies the genre too. It has so many, it's full of so many like unbearably suspenseful set pieces that if you're a fan of the chase film, or if you're a fan of the crime drama, there's plenty of stuff in that movie that you would just like eat up, because it like captures exactly what you would want from that genre, but then also kind of pulls the rug out from under you in other respects.
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones is a policeman on his last job, and he's gonna retire, and it's sort of so weird to see him actually retired. So, I mean, that's the last scene. Right. The last scene is him going, "What are you going to do today?" I don't know. No, I'm not a policeman. I had a dream last night. I've got time to tell you about this. I'm not going anywhere. So, you know, and that, I think that the surprise of how that film ends is totally earned by the fact that you've seen Anton go on, and so when you're watching Tommy Lee Jones, you know, prattle on about the dream. I mean, I love that scene, but that's what he's doing. You're kind of the genre person inside you, the seasoned watcher of this kind of film, is waiting for the telephone to ring, because someone's going to ring and going to say, "Hey, you know that guy you were looking for? We just got to call it on the radio."
Why they're
suddenly from New York and New Mexico now. I'm walking here.
Yeah, but you expect it.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though you shouldn't. Like, if you know you're in the Coen brothers' hands, and you know that there's all sorts of, like you said, with the scene with him wandering off, they're very much, or the scene where you do not see, what's his name?
Josh Brolin.
Josh Brolin. You don't see Josh Brolin's death. So there's all these very clear announcements that they're not here to give you what you think you're going to get. But you're right. I agree with you that even so, up to the very final moments, you're still expecting that phone call, or that, you know, that twist where he shows up at the house, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, he goes out on the porch and he's sitting there. I hear you've been looking for me, Sheriff, you know?
Right, right, right. Or, you know, you hear the coin being flipped or something, right?
And Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the coin flip is, of course, sort of speaks to your sort of central thesis of like, you know, the idea of fate, the idea of, you know, there is this, it can go heads or can go tails, and the way it's going to go, that coin has been traveling through its entire history.
Right.
To get to this point,
right?
You know,
and I love the wife character in that film when she refuses to call it, and it's such a powerful moment, and you hear her and you're like, yeah, like good for her, you know, like that's she's not playing his game, but to not play the game is to still play the game, you know, like if you refuse to play, he's still going to play for you. He's going to force you to play.
Yeah. But that's, I see what you mean. And me as a complete moral coward would be like, oh, screw it, heads. You know what I mean? I wish I was, but what she gives you is, I think, is a third way. To your sort of the proposed idea of determinism, no freedom, or some room for freedom, and she carves out a sort of third route of like, I'm just not gonna give you the benefit of meaning. I'm not gonna give you meaning. You know, there was a brilliant Holocaust film by the actor Tim Blake Nelson called The Grey Zone.
Haven't seen that.
Right.
I want to.
Well, there's a superb moment in that where someone is they're having an argument. One of the Jewish sort of doctors, basically, who has been assisting in the medical experiments in the camp as a way of surviving. You know, obviously that choice is not a choice that is just an open choice for him.
Right.
And he's trying to justify himself, and he's sort of saying, well, you know, maybe what if something, even in the midst of all this horror, what if we discover something that will save lives or something like that? And the other, his fellow prisoner says, no, you're doing the worst thing in the world. You're giving them a meaning. You're giving them, you know, you're giving them a kind of justification by participating.
Yeah.
And it's that similar thing of like, okay, the world can be chaotic and arbitrary and cruel and nasty, but it can do it without my participation.
Yeah.
You know, I totally agree with you. That's the most heroic moment of that movie is to just pull out of it. Even though, you know, it's he's going to kill you.
And that makes me, this might be an odd connection, but it almost makes me think of that character in Hamlet who, like the little side character who turns out to have this big heroic role in the narrative. There's, I think it's like a guard or something. It's been a while since I've read Hamlet, but there's a guard who comes out and has like two lines and is like, wait, like you don't have to do this. And then is quickly like, you know, taken away or whatever. And I think C.S. Lewis wrote an essay about how that was like his favorite, that character who has two lines in Hamlet is like his favorite character in all of Shakespeare, because he was the one to be like, no, it doesn't have to be this way. So yeah, those I live for those like little moments in films. Like that tiny little like blip that shows a character kind of going, I don't know, going against the grain, or like calling out this like vast controlling system for what it is. They can't escape it necessarily, but they exercise some control at least by being aware of it, I guess.
It's almost as if it goes with the meta idea that we're watching a film with characters reading lines, doing something, and trapped inside a plot and inside a genre, inside a narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, horror films, and this will bring us to some other movies that you mentioned. I remember there was a film. I miss it. It doesn't happen so much these days. I really miss it when you would hear about a film and not see it for ages. You know, you'd hear. So everybody was talking about Wolf Creek, and everybody had seen it, and they were talking about it. But for some reason, I was in Italy. I couldn't get. And somebody finally turned up with a copy of the DVD, and I watched it. Yeah. And everybody had talked about how gruesome the last half an hour is.
Mm.
And but what I found incredible about that film that is that the first hour or so, it's like one of those, it's like Psycho or Audition maybe, that it starts as a generically as one thing and then shifts into something else. So at the beginning, it's just kind of a road movie, and you're getting to know these characters, and the characters are very well acted and very well written and very realistic. And I found myself, because I knew this isn't going well, they're trapped in the horror genre.
Right, right.
Can't this be a comedy? Do we have to go there? You know, it seems so nice.
You know what you're. Well, I love how you said that. Trapped in the genre. That's just it. I don't know. That makes me think almost of. I know I mentioned it already, but it makes me think of Midsommar again, that. Minus the opening sequence, which is very horrific, a good chunk of the movie is like an exploration of a culture. You know, it's almost like an ethnographic analysis of this subculture, and it's funny too. It's really funny in at points, and then you know you like the. You like the characters, you care about them, you enjoy like hanging out with them, you know, the like ignorant, you know, friend who's like vaping during the ceremony is funny, and you know, he's kind of a jackass, but you like him, but you know that it's not going to end well for him. You know that he's going to become the skinned fool at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, could that be what genre is almost? It's sort of like locking in sort of a formula and an algorithm of fate. It's like this is, you know, this is the equation, and the characters are just going to drop in as the A, you know, as the element in the algebra, you know. And this guy is the victim, and this is the, you know, what was the film I watched yesterday? I watched Brightburn, and the black sheriff in Brightburn has exactly the same role as the chef in Holloran in The Shining, you know?
Oh, okay, yeah.
This black guy is just turning, and the fact that he's black as well, I don't think is coincidental. I think there's a sort of like the sacrificial sort of aspect of it. And it's sort of like this guy is going to show up two-thirds of the way through as the, I'm here to rescue the situation, and whack.
Right.
He's, you know,
and then immediately die. Yeah.
Spoiler for, you know, he's a blood bag just heading for his execution. And it's that same sort of idea of inevitability. So it's like the guy in Star Trek realizing he's putting on a red shirt, you know, it's like, ah, oh, shit, I guess I'm this guy. You know?
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful way of putting it, of it's, you know, it's this equation, and these characters are just being plugged into this equation. And
because you mentioned Kill List and the Ben Wheatley film, and that is almost it's very similar to Midsommar. I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on that film.
Oh yeah, I love Kill List.
It's brilliant.
Kill List
isn't it?
It is, and it's one that I'm glad I went in fairly cold. I knew that it was like a crime film with like maybe some horror elements, and that's really all I knew. And it just blew me away. And I think like the folk horror genre is especially like fertile territory for this idea of people just being plugged into an equation. So like I forget his name, but the main character in Kill List, you could, once you see the whole movie, and speaking of spoiler alerts, here comes one, but once you see the whole thing, you realize that he's always been that person. He's always been set up to be the one to sacrifice his family. And there's that amazing scene towards the beginning where he's kind of having like a play sword fight with his family, and I think his son, correct me if I got this wrong, but his son is on like his wife's back, and he's having a sword fight with them. And that is almost a perfect replication of the final sacrificial scene where his son is like tied to his wife, and they're that like weird cloaked beast that he has to kill. And that role has been assigned to him. That dark organization, whatever they are, their motives and reason for existing is never explained. Maybe it can't be explained, right? But they've been orchestrating things sort of behind the curtains throughout the whole film, and his role was always going to be the one to kill the hunchback. I think it's called the hunchback. He was always going to be the one to kill the hunchback, and they've and just like that, I would connect that even to, I write about Hereditary. From the very beginning, Peter, the brother character, was being, the forces beyond his control were at work, arranging things very specifically so that he would become, the reincarnation of his sister. Because we were talking about like folk horror, even in like The Wicker Man, the cop was brought to this island and for the sole purpose of becoming this sacrifice. And there's absolutely nothing he could have done about it to escape that role. But yeah, Kill List is brilliant. And talking about like playing with genre too, because that's one that has almost like a 180 from like, grimy crime drama to folk horror, like in with a snap. And but somehow it works. It's startling, but it works. It doesn't feel like a trick, and I'm not quite sure how Ben Wheatley pulls that off, but it's very impressive.
I'd argue that there's also in his choice of editing, his choice of performances, the way the performances are, it plays out at the very beginning almost like a Mike Leigh film or a Ken Loach film, which is and they do movies which you would, I think wrongly would be categorized as sort of outside of genres, and social realism is sort of like, of course social realism is its own genre, it has its own markers. The fact that Kill List can kind of do that, and at the opening, that the scene of him and his wife arguing, the party, could easily be from a Pinter, could easily be from some sort of British TV Mike Leigh Abigail's Party sort of thing from the 70s or 80s. It's just very naturalistic. It's very the documentary almost. The cutting is really off-puttingly unprofessional, if you know what I mean. It's not smooth. It's not a movie. It's not a slick crime drama. And then it goes into that, and then it goes into the horror. So it's sort of like.
Yeah, it's like three movies. You're totally right.
And by far the best thing he's ever done as well. It's like
agreed. And the kitchen sink stuff in the beginning is fantastic. And I love the opening scene and the first shot is like in medias res where it's like mid argument. And I think the first line is the wife like screaming into the camera, like, there is no fucking money. You know, they're having this big, like, and like, you know, the marriage might end argument. And we're just like thrown right into this thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's brilliantly innovative in the sense that I love films which start with something really big like that, where you don't even know who are these people? Whose side am I supposed to be on? Who,
right.
You know, I've not been introduced. It's sort of like it's an unwarranted intimacy that's being forced upon me. I should right. I should be get to know these people before I get to this level of naked honesty. You know,
right? Yeah.
It's really off-putting, and it's really brilliantly keeps you constantly. Off-put. Is that a way I can say it?
I think so. I think that works.
Okay. What about there's another film that I want to do, and I know we're coming towards the end now, so I'm very aware. I'm just so aware that so much I want to talk about in terms of this book
I'm happy to keep talking. Yeah.
But on a sort of another, if you like, another sort of level, a filmmaker who you mentioned in your book, Christopher Nolan, of course, has you know, I mean, with The Prestige, with Tenet, you talk about in terms of him playing with time, in terms of him Memento, of course, plays with time by going backwards, the Prestige with the doppelganger, these all seem to be. You know, I mean, famously has syncope. His company is sort of a Esker-style labyrinth. Is the
right?
You know, he seems to be absolutely obsessed with fate as well, and the inevitability of having to fulfill certain roles.
Yeah, I think so for sure. Yeah, Tenet was really fun to write about. I have very mixed emotions about that movie. I like love bits of it, and I really, really don't like other parts of it. But I do think that the central, I love like the centerpiece chase where the two timelines kind of merge, and I think that, you know, the car chase is playing forwards and backwards at the same time, and like the forward moving version of the car chase wouldn't be able to occur without the simultaneous backward moving version of the car chase. So again, it's like the past feeding into the future feeding into the past, and they rely on one another in order to exist. Which is, I think that scene is brilliant. And I'm glad you mentioned the maze, because that's another image that I kind of keep returning to whenever I try to like articulate my thoughts about the book and about certain movies. Of course, there's the hedge maze in The Shining. And there's this sort of like part of the genesis of the book, and I talk about it in the introduction, is I kept returning to this idea of the maze and how that sort of embodies this idea of compatibilism, being, you know, you do have freedom sort of, but within certain constraints. You know, it's like walking through a maze. You can, if you reach a T junction, you can go left, you can go right. There's some freedom there, but you can't go straight.
Right.
And the wall in front of you is like the deterministic, you know, element to the choices that you can make in life. And I can't take credit for that. That's something I remember a philosophy professor of mine talking, like using that metaphor when explaining compatibilism, and that memory, which really stuck with me from school, when I made the connection between that memory and the central role of the hedge maze in The Shining, that was kind of one of the initial, like, yes, light bulb moments where I was able to start pulling these threads together of these different movies.
But I'm interested in flipping that as well, because I don't mean by flipping it by contradicting or anything, but there's also this notion that without obstacles, you don't have a map, in the sense that if I'm looking at that whiteboard and I was really interested in you starting with that sort of the T junction, and the, it's a great, you know, you get to choose, but you don't get to choose your choices. You know, you have the menu,
exactly.
The menu, order off the menu, which I know as an American is almost the terrible thing that you can't do.
No, you can't. Yeah.
But imagine a whiteboard in which, you know, or imagine the maze in The Shining, and he's looking down and there's no maze and there's just two people in a sheet of white.
Right.
That's also terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, okay, you've got left, right, you can't go ahead, but the obstacles are giving you direction. They're giving you something to kick against. They're giving you some way of gauging where we are in time. Going back to the Brian Greene idea of time from a sort of quantum level, you know, the heat death of the universe, at the end of the universe, it's when there won't be two atoms close enough together to communicate information. And at that point, there's no such thing as time. Once you don't get an interaction, once you don't get an exchange of information, then time has effectively stopped, because nothing will ever happen from then on. And if nothing's ever going to happen, then how can you tell that this is different from that?
Yeah.
You know,
that is terrifying.
So we have to love our fate. We have to love our maze.
Yeah. Love the maze. I think, no, you're right, though. The idea of there being no maze, and, you know, the overhead shot of The Shining being replaced with the mini Wendy and Danny just wandering around like a white void is horrifying. Because if there is no maze, there's nothing to interact with. And if there's nothing to interact with, that might even be worse than fate, because in that case, you're just in like a void, and or you're in, you know, nothingness. So yeah, I mean, maybe the maze isn't so bad after all.
We got there. we've managed to make fate and doom into something, which is not too bad. Well, I think you might have quoted it in your book, Albert Camus, talking about the myth of Sisyphus, and saying, you know, well, on the bright side, he's got something to do. You
know? Right. Yeah, exactly. And there's a heroism in continuing to do it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And choosing to continue. Well, I don't know. It's not really a choice, but in performing the thing that you're forced to do with like honor and dignity, that there's a beauty to that. So, I do talk about that in the book, and I connected to Scorsese's After Hours.
Right. Yes. Another brilliant film.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love After Hours. But yeah, I mean, like Sisyphus rolling the rock back up the hill, you know, Paul Hackett goes back to work and turns on the computer, and, you know, he gets back to it. And there's a kind of heroism to that.
I like to think, though, that the minute that shot, well, I mean, you mentioned it, that he sort of disappears from the shot, but it's almost like the minute he's like 10 minutes later, he's in the bathroom sleeping on in the queue. In the bathroom, he's like, oh, no way I'm going to be able to work all day.
Yeah, this was a mistake.
Today's going to be a nap day.
Yeah, sleeping at the desk. That's funny.
Brilliant. Listen, Tom, let's have a recommended book from you.
Yeah. So like many of your previous guests, I'm going to cheat horribly and I'm going to give three, if that's okay.
That's fine.
And I've got two that were very influential in terms of my writing of fate and film. Mm. So I've got Pippin's Filmed Thought, which is, I think I haven't read a ton of philosophy on film books, but a pretty good amount. And I think that's the best one I've ever read by far. He has this brilliant analysis of Cirque's, is it All That Heaven Allows?
That's
a Cirque film. So that's one that, just in terms of like exploring the intersections between film and philosophy, I think that one is just fantastic. Maureen Foster's Alien in the Mirror was very helpful for me when I was writing the Glazer chapter. And that whole book is about, almost exclusively about Under the Skin. And I love Under the Skin. So I just ate that book up. A book that I just had fun reading, not really connected to any of my writing, is American Twilight, and it's a collection, and it's the subtitle is The Cinema of Toby Hooper, and it's like a reassessment of Toby Hooper's work, and there's a little bit on Texas Chainsaw, but 98% of the book is on his other movies. And I love like the underdog interpretation, like reassessment of some of these directors' work, because when you look at someone like Toby Hooper, you're like, oh yeah, he made, you know, the best horror film ever possibly, and then like never did anything remotely close to that ever again. So he's kind of written off. But that collection is, I really loved reading, because you know, you have writers defending like The Mangler, his movie about like the killer laundry machine or whatever, right? And I love when people reassess stuff that's sometimes written off as just like garbage, and saying like, well, wait a minute, maybe there is something else here that's going on that's interesting and worth talking about. And you know, when I finished reading the chapter on The Mangler, I was like, huh, maybe the movie really is about like worker exploitation and, you know, and all this other stuff. And anyway, it made me look at his work in a different way, which I love, because he's one where a lot of his stuff is kind of written off post Texas Chainsaw. But
does it have a chapter on life force?
Yes, there's a chapter on life force, that's his Hammer film,
right?
Basically,
right.
And I think he's even called it that himself. Mm. And then there's chapters on like his last one, Djinn.
Right.
There's a whole chapter on Djinn. It made me want to go and watch Djinn, which I thought would never happen. So if a book can do that to me, I think that's pretty impressive.
I'm quite fascinated by these film directors who the trajectory of their careers, you know, are very sort of marked. I'll give you another example, would be someone like, William Friedkin would be someone who has had that sort of 1970s was huge and then couldn't get arrested for the, you know, and then made sort of fairly disappointing films and now has had something of a resurgence. Who's the other? Mm-hmm. In Italy, Dario Argento sort of, you know, couldn't seem to put a foot wrong for a decade. And then somehow kind of, I don't know, just completely seemed to lose it. I mean, I know that some people say his last one is supposed to be something of a return to form, but it's like, you know, it's like waiting for the good Bob Dylan album in the 80s. It's just like, it's just not good. Even if it, you know, our definition of good is going to have to change. If we're,
right.
You know,
right.
If we're not going to be really disappointed.
Friedkin's a really interesting one. I know one that I know that like he thinks is a very good film, and a lot of people don't think it is, but it's been like reassessed some in the past maybe decade or so, would be like Cruising. Which is certainly a very problematic film, but a really fascinating film. So I like a good fascinating failure. Those are always a lot of fun.
And I really like Cruising. I'll stand up for Cruising. I think it's good.
Yeah, Cruising's good. That's another one that has a very strange kind of like baffling ending.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. A little bit of him sort of rehearsing or redoing his French Connection ending, which seemed to be something that he could never get over. I think Live and Die in LA has a similar sort of, you know, has one of those endings where he kind of, spoiler for Live and Die in LA, he kind of kills off his main character in a really surprising way, sort of preempts your expectation.
Yeah. Yeah. To Live and Die in LA and then Cruising both have the new protagonist very like moodily wearing sunglasses, right?
Yes.
Isn't that kind of the image? Yeah. I love when directors like just shamelessly embrace redoing the same ending over and over. Like I love that Paul Schrader has copied the ending to Pickpocket at least three times, and I think that's great. I just think that's fascinating. I love when you can tell they're like obsessed with it, and like you go. I went into the card counter and I was like, I wonder if he's gonna do a riff on the Pickpocket ending with this one, and he did, and it wasn't surprising, but I loved it, and that's.
It's like their font.
Their obsession.
Yeah, exactly. Or the little signature at the end, a little flourish as they finish their work.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, it's been brilliant talking to you, Thomas. I've really, really loved the book, and there was a moment where you mentioned Derrida, and I've been to the temple of high postmodernism, and I shriveled at the naming of the one who must not be named, and I thought, oh no, where are we going please. But you managed to talk about really interesting complicated ideas, but in a way which is very, very accessible and very and just, you know, made me want to go and watch these movies again. And as you can tell from this conversation, made me think of other movies you could apply those ideas to.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, well, thank you for your kind words, and that means a lot, and I had a blast talking, so yeah, thanks for having me.
So that was me and Tom talking about determinism and film and so much more, and we really got into it. I'm glad I had the opportunity to talk to Tom, and hopefully we'll be having a further conversation some way along the line. We're coming up to our 100th episode. We're episode 95, I think, at the moment. So hopefully, as we go forward, hopefully we're going to have some exciting guests leading up to the 100th, and then loads of exciting guests afterwards as well going forward. So that would be that's really good. If you yourself have written a book, or you know somebody who has, or you have a recommendation of someone that you would like me to interview, a writer who you particularly admire and would like to hear them talk about their work, then by all means get in touch with me. The Twitter account that I have is open. The DMs are open, or you can email me drjohnty, drjohnty @gmail.com. Okay, thank you very much for the support you give. I really appreciate it. I have some great people out there: Andy English, Kai Ross, some brilliant Italian listeners like Andrea, Loads of people. So thank you so much for all the support, and I will talk to you next week. Take care.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.